This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. More than 203,000 people have now died worldwide from COVID-19, and health officials have confirmed nearly 3 million cases since the outbreak of the disease in China last December. This is according to tallies compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Here's some news from around the world on how nations are responding. Chinese officials said Sunday that all COVID-19 patients have been discharged from hospitals in Wuhan, the origin of the outbreak in the country late last year. Wuhan, which saw roughly half of all China's coronavirus cases, was placed into a strict lockdown in January and sealed off from the rest of the country. Though many restrictions have been eased, residents are still being regularly tested for the virus. Most of the globe remained on lockdown over the weekend in an effort to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. But in Spain, officials did allow children to go outside for the first time in 6 weeks, beginning Sunday. For weeks, only adults have been allowed to leave their homes in Spain and for essential reasons only. Italy and France, two other hard-hit countries in Europe, are beginning to carefully ease social restrictions as well. In the United Kingdom, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the first world leader to test positive for COVID-19, is expected to return to work on Monday after weeks of recovery. India, which imposed one of the strictest lockdowns, has allowed some neighborhood stores to reopen. New York, still an epicenter of the global pandemic, will soon allow residents to go to their local pharmacies for COVID-19 testing. Governor Andrew Cuomo said Saturday that 5,000 pharmacies will be allowed to conduct the tests, with the goal of carrying out 40,000 tests each day. This is VOA News. As we've been reporting, countries around the world are reacting to the COVID-19 pandemic differently. Some are easing restrictions, while others are outlining new guidelines for behavior. In Israel, all shops, apart from malls, are now open. Saudi Arabia will relax its curfew between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., but around-the-clock lockdown will stay in place in hot spots, including the Muslim holy city of Mecca. And Saudi Arabia will continue the suspension of international and domestic flights until further notice, with the exception of emergency cases. Beijing says it will ban uncivilized behavior, such as not covering one's mouth and nose when coughing or sneezing, as part of new regulations to improve public hygiene. Rule breakers will be fined for offenses, including not wearing a mask in public when ill. Several countries and territories have made wearing masks in public spaces obligatory. Nigeria's Lagos is the latest to join that list. In other world news, North Korea has not announced who would follow leader Kim Jong-un in the event he is incapacitated. And with no real firm details about his young children, analysts say his sister and loyalists could form a regency until a successor is old enough to take over. South Korean and Chinese officials have publicly cast doubt on reports that Kim is gravely ill following a cardiovascular procedure. After his absence from a key state anniversary event on April 15th, triggered speculation about his health. But the media reports sparked questions about who is in place to take over if Kim, thought to be about 36 and a third-generation hereditary leader, fell seriously ill or died. He became leader when his father died suddenly in 2011 from a heart attack. Under Kim Jong-un, though, North Korea's arsenal of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles has grown substantially, raising concerns over who would control them. The United Nations is marking International Chernobyl Disaster Remembrance Day Sunday, which is the 34th anniversary of the accident that spread a radioactive cloud over large parts of Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia. The United Nations says persistent and serious long-term consequences remain more than 30 years after the explosion and fire at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine. The anniversary is being marked after fires recently burned in the 30-kilometer exclusion zone around the plant, raising concerns about the potential release of radioactive particles into the air. The International Atomic Energy Agency said that the increase in levels of radiation measured in the country was very small and posed no risk to human health. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The president did not close the churches. I think the churches themselves felt there was a need to do that. And even the reopening, individual churches will make a decision.
A spokesperson denies accusations. Zambian President Edgar Lungu orders churches to open Sunday.
We are doing all we can to help the government combat the COVID-19 disease. We are doing this through the statements we are issuing, and Dr. Chakwera is doing this by the messages he's sending out to the entire population of this country, advising them to comply with all the measures put down by the World Health Organization.
A major Malawian opposition party denies carrying out COVID-19 misinformation campaign in the run-up to the presidential poll.
We believe that the government has failed, and the only way to protect these civilians is by MONUSCO doing their job. If they're not doing their job, we do not understand why they're there.
And a Democratic Republic of Congo civil society group calls on the government to step up efforts to protect civilians from rebel attacks. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, the presidential spokesperson has denied accusations that President Edgar Lungu directed churches to open for services Sunday. This despite imposed restrictions aimed at halting the spread of the coronavirus. Isaac Chipampe says while addressing the nation, the president simply gave worshippers the option to congregate while observing social distancing as one of the ways to stop the spread of the disease. But critics say the president's directive is yet another demonstration that he has been ineffective in the fight against the disease. They said his advisers are to blame for the president's missteps and should be fired and replaced by competent people. But presidential spokesperson Chipampe rejected the resignation demands as without merit. He tells me that the president will not be distracted by critics in his commitment to limit the spread of the disease.
I think some people have just chosen to misunderstand the president because they are saying the president ordered the churches to reopen. In the first place, the president did not order the churches to close. The president ordered some of the activities to be halted. For example, the president said you cannot go into a pub and sit and start having a drink. And also he ordered that the food should be delivered to people's households, or at least they should just be takeaway. Those are the two major issues that he ordered. The markets are still open. The churches at that point were restricted to 50 people attending sermons or masses. But what we are hearing is strange because some people have decided to mislead everybody that the president has ordered to reopen the churches. The churches, the president did not in the first place close the churches. It's the churches themselves that decided that they close and they congregate as families in their homes. And so the president yesterday said people could go to church, but they should observe social distancing. That's what the president was emphasizing, that they may go to church, but observe social distancing. He was not ordering to reopen the churches because he didn't close them in the first place.
The critics were saying, after accusing the president of ordering the churches to open or to freely congregate, are calling on the president to fire his advisers, since they believe the advisers wrongly advised the president to order the churches to open. What are your views about calls for the president to fire his advisers, whom they say are not serving the president well?
Well, Peter, I'm part of the the advisers, and I don't think that I'll be the right person to comment on whether the president should fire us or not. But We meet. The president is a democratic president, so we meet, and if people have ideas and they want to advise the president, they do, we do. And the president also fears issues that he feels should be decided upon. He briefs us, and it's not like the president was just given the speech to read. He looked at it and he assessed it, and he was very sure that the message that was being delivered was well couched. So we will allow people to discuss this issue, although it's an welcome, it's a distraction. I think people should be focusing more on the issue at hand, which is the COVID pandemic, rather than debating whether the president was misled or not.
Isaac, what do you say to the critics who are saying that the president shouldn't have even given the churches an option to open because of the ongoing crisis associated with the coronavirus, which a lot of countries have imposed restrictions to ensure it curbs or halts its spread?
As I said, the president did not close the churches. I think the churches themselves felt there was need to do that. And even the reopening, individual churches will make a decision. But of course, there are some churches that feel that they should reopen. And there are some churches that strongly feel this is not the right time to do so. And the government will not force them to either reopen or not. So that one, even before it happened, like I said, the president and the government had decided that only 50 people also should congregate. So the churches were already implementing that.
Isaac, realistically, what is the president's message to the people of Zambia at this crucial time when measures are being implemented to curb the spread of the coronavirus, despite criticisms that the Lusaka should have been shut down, the international airport shut down, and the borders should also have been shut down? What do you say to the people of Zambia?
The president and the government have made a lot of headway in terms of protecting the people against the pandemic. Cabinet always meet at least once a week to ensure that they come up with one voice and there's input from all the ministers. So the issue of the airports, for instance, have already been discussed. Three airports were closed down. We are just remaining with one airport at the moment. And this has helped because at least the medicines and so forth that is supposed to be imported in the country. For example, PPEs are able to come into the country because at least one international airport is operating. So that has helped. But the closing of major points at the airports has also worked in a positive way, as we have noticed that the importation of the disease in the country has slowed down. But in terms of the road transport, before we even closed the... In fact, we haven't closed the borders. The other countries, as you know, we are landlocked. So the other countries like Zimbabwe have already... closed the border, so there was no need for us to even close.
Isaac Chipampe is the spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, denies that it is spreading misinformation about the coronavirus. This after some Malawians say the opposition party is playing politics with the crisis to score political points ahead of the upcoming July presidential election. Critics say supporters of the opposition party have also threatened to attack health workers who were scheduled to begin contact tracing in the Kalieka area in the capital, Lilongwe, Friday. Officials have so far confirmed 33 cases of COVID-19, with 3 deaths and 4 recovered. Maurice Muntali, spokesperson for the MCP, tells me that the accusations are untrue. He also says they are aimed at tarnishing the reputation of the party and its presidential candidate before the poll.
I can state very clearly here and without fear of contradiction that those allegations are not true, they are unfounded, and they are laughable, because it is Dr. Lazarus Chakwera who has repeatedly warned Malawians against the COVID-19 disease. In fact, we have even issued statements on behalf of President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera as Malawi Congress Party, advising and sensitizing the Malawian population as to how they can combat the COVID-19 disease. Actually, it is the DPP administration that are not approaching the fight against COVID-19 disease holistically. They are tackling the issue partially, they are tackling the issue politically, and they do not want to portray a picture that a pandemic is not only real, but it needs an approach that is going to be very effective and that is going to protect the population of this country.
Maurice, supporters of the government are of the view that the MCP is just playing mere politics ahead of the July elections and that it is not genuine in helping with the fight against the spread of the disease.
Let the DPP administration not waste time blaming anybody else. Rather, they should blame themselves for politicizing this fight against the COVID-19 disease. What Dr. Chakwera is saying is that a lockdown is very necessary because that is one measure all countries are implementing or employing to combat the coronavirus. But you cannot order a lockdown before providing necessities for Malawians to survive the lockdown itself. Otherwise, through the lockdown, many people are going to die, and dying of hunger more than they would have died of COVID-19. Dr. Chakwera is saying the health workers must be a priority in terms of how we protect them, because we cannot let them be vulnerable by not providing them with the personal protective equipment. And the medical facilities themselves must be equipped with the items and the equipment that they need. We are also saying, through Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, that you cannot implement measures to combat this disease by leaving out some other crucial and very critical areas. You close schools, you close churches, you close markets, and then you leave the borders open. I mean, you are playing games with this COVID-19 disease, and yet it is the same government that is saying most of the cases are imported. And that is just playing with the COVID-19 disease itself. The government isn't serious, and they are politicizing this.
Maurice, what you are saying, the government said it implemented measures to help the less privileged in society, and that what you are saying is neither here nor there, because you are supporting the court action that stopped the 21-day lockdown orchestrated by HRDC, a political pressure group supported by the MCP, to thwart the government's effort to fight to curb or halt the disease in Malawi.
We are not saying no to any lockdown, and as alluded to earlier, a lockdown is very necessary, and most countries are employing that measure to combat the COVID-19 disease. But what we are saying, and this must be understood very clear, we are saying before you order a lockdown, you must put measures as to how people are going to survive in their homes. Because in Malawi, people feed themselves because of what they can find each day, and you cannot lock people down for 3 weeks without having to give them anything else. And they haven't announced any measures as to how people are going to survive the lockdown itself. So we're not frustrating the lockdown. And by going to the court, the HRDC, we're not saying a lockdown is bad. What the HRDC and all of us are saying is that let us sit down. How are people going to manage their lives during the lockdown? And that's why there is an inter-party. It's not like a no to a lockdown. It's like, let us sit down and let the government be given time to think about how they're going to keep people alive so that they don't die more from the lockdown than they would have died through COVID-19.
Maurice, a lot of people are saying that this is the time for unity. This is the time to shun politics. This is the time where people need to show patriotism in the fight against the disease. They accuse the MCP of not doing so, but constantly criticizing the government effort instead of supporting it in the fight against this disease.
What's your reaction to that?
From where we stand as Malawi Congress Party, we feel we are doing enough. We are doing all we can to help the government combat the COVID-19 disease. We are doing this through the statements we are issuing, and Dr. Chakwera is doing this by the messages he's sending out to the entire population of this country, advising them to comply with all the measures put down by the World Health Organization, measures that can keep people safe so that they don't contract the coronavirus. And yet, we are doing all this without having been invited by the government itself. The question remains then, what can we do apart from what we are doing if the government is not ready to incorporate every one of us in the fight against this coronavirus? So we feel that the government is not willing to incorporate, include, and invite all of us so that we can fight together as a nation, because COVID-19 is real and we don't need to fight COVID-19, the pandemic, as separate entities. We have to work together, and this is what DPP administration is not willing to do.
Maurice Muntali is the spokesperson for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from Nzuzu. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, the Mohoro Peace Association, a civil society group, says the government should uphold its constitutional mandate to protect unarmed civilians. This after rebels from the Mai Mai group allegedly attacked Banyamulenge women using machetes. The group also says soldiers from the National Army, as well as peacekeepers from the United Nations Force or MONUSCO, could have prevented the attacks and saved many of the women killed during the attacks. Adela Kibasumba, president of the Mahoro Peace Association, says it's regrettable that the government is failing to protect its citizens. She tells me that the government must step up and do more to protect vulnerable women and children from rebel attacks.
On April 18, 2020, two Banyamulenge women were killed by the Mai Mai rebel group after being subjected to the most atrocious form of torture and humiliating acts of sexual violence. We have graphic images of their mutilated bodies, which have left the community completely traumatized. The victims were part of a group of dozen women who left their place of refuge in Minembwe in desperation and headed to the villages that they previously fled from to harvest some food with escort of a Congolese army. The account of a sole female survivor who was freed after days of negotiations raises concern about the ambiguous role played by the soldiers of the Congolese army in this. But also, these attacks have been taking place for more than a year and a half. So this is not new, but it's ongoing, and it's just looking like a genocide going on for the Banyamulenge people in Minembwe.
What has been the reaction of the Congolese army after you brought this to their attention?
There was no reaction from the Congolese army. When the bodies were recovered a day after, the bodies were carried and left at the residency of the Congolese general in Minembwe. The community highly, highly believes that the Congolese army was implicated and they play a role in the killing and the raping of these women. So there are answers to be answered. The community is waiting and pleading for answers and for protection.
Is your group engaging the government to investigate this?
Mahoro Peace Association does call for the government to investigate and to shed some light on what happened and why the government soldiers who were accompanying these women did nothing to protect these women, did nothing to intervene when the Mai Mai groups were attacking and raping these women. And they were nowhere to be found while all this was happening.
Some are calling for international intervention as well as MONUSCO to intervene to protect the people. What is your group saying about international intervention to help protect the unarmed civilians?
That's right, Peter. Our government has failed us. This conflict has been going on for a year and a half now, and the Banyamulenge people have been systematically attacked by killing them, raping the women, looting their property, burning them to the ground, stealing their cattle, and we have called for a government to intervene and act. But instead, our government has failed the Banyamulenge people miserably. Now, we have a UN peacekeeping mission in Minembwe, few kilometers from where this act happened. And as we understand, their mandate is to protect unarmed civilians like these women's, and they're good. But instead, we do not know where the MONUSCO is. There have been absent in a humanitarian crisis also that have been happening in this area, and they have not been present in really protecting civilians. We believe that the government has failed, and the only way to protect these civilians is by MONUSCO doing their job. If they're not doing their job, I do not understand, we do not understand why they're there. They're there to protect people, and if they cannot protect civilians, they need to leave.
Adela Kibasumba is the president of the Mahoro Peace Association, a DRC civil society group. She spoke with me from New York. The Zimbabwean government has announced the reversal of price hikes on basic commodities that came after government order for a 21-day coronavirus lockdown sparked panic buying. Prices will be frozen at the old rates. For VOA, Kutsavai's Venavashi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Vice President Kembo Mohadi has been in charge of Interministerial Task Force on COVID-19. He told reporters that the lockdown announcement inspired unfair price hikes.
When His Excellency the President, Edi Mnangagwa, announced the lockdown, prices skyrocketed, generating increasing difficulties for the general public to access food items such as bread, sugar, cooking oil, vinegar, and flour.
In government's bid to resolve this, Mohadi says the Minister of Industry and Commerce held a multi-sectoral meeting with stakeholders, which included the Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe, Consumer Council of Zimbabwe, Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers, and others.
There was a general agreement that the price increase, particularly during the lockdown, was speculative and unjustified. So the multi-sectoral stakeholders committed to a price moratorium up to operate based on the prices which were applicable on the 25th of March 2020.
He adds that the moratorium is effective immediately and applies to all industry players. Mohadi's address to the media was followed by various heads of the stakeholders who were part of the meeting, pledging support of the moratorium and assuring the price reversal and freeze will be initiated. Political analyst Rashid Mukundu says the moratorium comes with a risk.
There is a high risk that government's interventions to control the price of basic goods may actually result in shortages. What we'll see is that goods would start disappearing from our shelves.
Government and stakeholders do not foresee shortages of goods since the moratorium is the result of agreement by all stakeholders. The lockdown saw a demand of basic goods and very few shops opened to serve the public. This has resulted in long queues to get into shops as demand grew. As the rule of economics detects, this demand forced price hikes. The moratorium would be welcome to the majority of Zimbabweans who were finding it difficult to catch up with the runaway prices. Now, they wait to see if this will be enforced and adopted by retailers. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunamashi from Harare.
We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, then music from our African collection. But first, a Ghanaian engineer, educator, and novelist has led a group of students to invent a ventilator to help the country's healthcare system. Professor Fred Makbagonluri, provost and president of the Academic City College, says he's also working with the health authorities to supply hospitals in the fight to halt the spread of the coronavirus. Health officials say ventilators are vital to the treatment of those infected with the disease. They also say due to a global shortage of ventilators, Professor Makbagonluri's invention will be a lifesaver for Ghanaians and all Africans. This after the Ghanaian officials confirmed 1,279 cases with 10 deaths and 134 recovered. To learn more about this invention, I reached the American-trained engineer Professor Fred Makbagonluri in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Sure. As a result of the current crisis that we have and the shortages of ventilators in the Ghanaian healthcare system, I'm leading a team of students in developing a ventilator to help mitigate the current situation.
What is the progress report so far about it?
So we have developed four prototypes. Basically, it's a modular system that has a patient interface, and then it also has an input system. And the input system is basically where you generate the air oxygen source that powers the patient end. And we have what we call the electromechanical control systems. That is basically the electronic logic that ensures that when a patient begins to respond to respiratory activity, that we don't continue to drown them in air. So we are at a point now where we have four of such inputs into the patient interface system, and we have also developed the sensor systems that ensures that patients are not drowned when they start respiratory activity.
What is the collaboration with the health sector in Ghana to provide these ventilators for them to use in the treatment of this disease?
In fact, we haven't heard directly from the Ministry of Health. We have been working closely with the minister responsible for environment, science, technology, and innovation, the Honorable Frimpong Boateng. We have also been working closely with the Director General of Ghana Standards Authority, Professor Alex Dodu. Today we had a team of doctors come in from Kolebu Teaching Hospital, which is the premium teaching, medical teaching facility in the country. But we haven't spoken directly to the ministers involved, or for that matter, the deputies involved with the Ministry of Health. We are currently making efforts to get them on board as well. And I'm hoping that before week ends, we will see some expression of interest as the systems begin to reach a point where it could be integrated into the care system.
Prof, what do you see as the prospect of this invention?
Well, Peter, we know very well that ventilators are an integral part of the treatment for victims of coronavirus and also other acute respiratory illnesses. So whether in times of crisis or in times of peace, these devices are still needed. And the absence of them currently in the healthcare system means that we haven't quite stocked them up, even for periods where we are not in crisis. So I think in the long term, they are needed. They are an essential part of the care infrastructure. So my hope is that even beyond COVID-19, there is still the need to make sure that our hospital facilities, both in remote areas and in the cities, have access to these devices. And so we think that, you know, beyond all these crises, there is still a need and there is a market available even in the sub-region.
How are the authorities responding to this invention, and what are the plans to distribute it to all the health facilities across the nation to help with medical attention to the citizens?
Peter, I think some really key holders, such as the Minister for Environment, Science, Technology and Innovation, has been quite supportive in our efforts. The Honorable Frimpong Boateng has been particularly outstanding in his efforts to support us move this invention forward. The Director General of Ghana Standards Authority, Professor Alex Dodu, has visited our facilities, and so has we have also received a couple of doctors from Kolebu Teaching Hospital. So I think everybody sees the need for this technology at this time. We still don't know what the plans are long term to integrate this into the value stream of care. But we think that there is a need, and I think everybody recognizes it. We've gotten calls from DRC, we've gotten calls from Togo, and so we really think that there's an opportunity to make this an integral part of the healthcare process.
Professor Fred Mark Bagonluri is an American-trained engineer, provost, and president at the Academic City College. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The second wave of locust swarms is threatening people's lives and food in East Africa. One way to fight the swarms has been spraying them with pesticides, but border closures because of COVID-19 is slowing down the deliveries. Some farmers in Kenya are using organic tree oil to drive the locusts out of their farms. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The countries in East Africa are grappling with coronavirus pandemic and also locusts, vast swarms eating crops and grazing land, threatening farmers' livelihood. 40-year-old Sami Lorero, a farmer in Isiolo County, says he rarely leaves his farm these days since locusts descended for the second time in 2 months. Lorero says, just a week ago, locusts were here on my farm. We sprayed pesticides, it killed all of them. But there are more swarms in the hill. I'm so afraid, he says. I have not lost hope. I planted maize and vegetables again after losing them to the locust. We are so worried. In February, 8 East African countries, including Kenya, experienced swarms. Experts say this second wave, the offspring of the first wave, is larger than the first. The spread of desert locust swarms is blamed on unusual weather patterns, including heavy rain since October and general climate conditions. Kenyan government have been deploying aircraft to spray farms with pesticide, but the threat has not gone away, and now there are worries that slower shipment because of the coronavirus travel restrictions will delay new spraying. The last time Kenya experienced a locust invasion was in 1950s. 76-year-old Philip Mutsi was a boy then and saw the devastation locusts caused on farms. Musimi uses neem tree leaves and seeds to make organic pesticides. Musimi says when you are using neem pesticides, unlike the chemical ones which kill the locust, neem does not kill the locust. If you use the neem plant in your farm, locusts won't like the taste of the plant. They flee from the farm, he says. Farmers have long used neem tree oil to manage pests. Hamisi Williams is the Food and Agriculture Organization's representative for Kenya.
The issue of the neem is there, the story is out there, and people are trying it, and these are part of other trials that people are doing here and there. But you are looking at what is the magnitude? Is it able to deal with the situation we are dealing with now? Because we have waves, we have swarms in the field.
The Kenyan government says it has enough pesticides to fight the locust invasion for now. Williams says there have been delays in getting some chemical pesticides, but he fears lockdowns and slow delivery of goods may hamper the fight against the swarms.
As we're talking now, we have the stocks. This is not a problem now as we're talking. We have the stocks. Unless we got just a few that you'd find it delaying, because now probably if you wanted to fly them in, no flights are coming. Maybe they have to resort to sea, which takes a little bit of time. But as these are coming, we got the stocks to last us for some time. So we're not worried on that now. The only thing that may worry us is that if the condition continues for long and the countries continue doing lockdowns on most of the cities and the transport protection means, this may worry us for in the long run.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Agency warns the situation remains extremely alarming as more swarms mature in Kenya, Ethiopia and Somalia. The organization said the swarms threaten food security and people's livelihoods in the region as many farmers prepare to plant crops. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, FIFA, the World Football Governing Body, has announced that it will release all operational funding due to member associations for the years 2019 and 2020 in the coming days. FIFA says this is the first step of a relief plan to assist the footballing community impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. This measure will mean about $150 million will be distributed among 211 national football governing bodies around the world. FIFA President Gianni Infantino says this is the first step of a far-reaching financial relief plan to respond to the emergency across the whole footballing community. According to this plan, FIFA will release $500,000 to each member association in the coming days, as well as any remaining entitlement for 2019 and 2020. Meanwhile, CAF has announced that following the postponement of the semifinals of the CAF Interclub competition due to COVID-19, the finals of the Total CAF Confederation Cup and Total CAF Champions League 2019-2020 has been put on hold until further notice. The inaugural one-match final for the two competitions was originally scheduled as follows. For the CAF Confederation Cup, it was May 24, 2020 in Rabat, Morocco. And for the CAF Champions League, it was May 29, 2020 in Douala, Cameroon. In athletics, the delayed London Marathon could feature elite athletes only. The London Marathon race director says that's one of the options being considered, and there could be even a further delay. The London Marathon was due to take place today, Sunday, but was moved to October 4th because of the coronavirus pandemic. Nearly 43,000 runners took part in 2019, while Eliud Kipchoge and Kenenisa Bekele are set to tussle it out in the 2020 elite men's race. The Tokyo Marathon went ahead last month with elite runners only on largely deserted streets. The Berlin Marathon also will not go ahead as planned on September 27th after Germany extended a ban on large-scale gatherings until October 24th. And in boxing, Mike Tyson says he's planning on boxing again, but it's not a comeback. At 53, Mike Tyson, the former undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, said he's training to fight exhibition matches for charity. When he was at the height of his boxing powers, Tyson was can't-miss viewing. Each time he stepped into the ring, there was the possibility of another brutal knockout, perhaps even within the first 30 seconds. He retired in 2005 after losing to Kevin McBride. He has since dabbled in acting, most notably playing himself in The Hangover, and voiced himself in the animated Mike Tyson Mysteries. He revealed during an Instagram interview recently that he has been training to fight again, not with a comeback bid in mind, but instead for a worthy cause. He said he wants to get in shape to be able to box 3 or 4 rounds exhibitions for some charities. Some charity exhibitions, make some money, help some homeless and drug-afflicted people like me, he said. In 2012, Tyson, who has a record of 50 fights, losing 6 and winning 44 by knockout, founded the Mike Tyson Cares Foundation, whose mission is to give kids a fighting chance by funding centers that provide for comprehensive needs of children from broken homes. On November 22, 1986, when he was 20, he scored a second-round technical knockout of Trevor Burbick to become the youngest heavyweight champion in history by capturing the WBC title. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Oh,
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is an unthinking man who achieves prosperity and then finds with time that his body can no longer pass through the door. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.